Chapter 2. Black Lives Matter. Black lives do matter, but it must matter to black people first. Arthur Reed, ex-gang leader. The RGI has many offspring, front organizations, and troll groups, but Black Lives Matter, BLM, is its militant wing and general purpose mob. This wholly owned subsidiary of the RGI attempts to present itself as a simple grassroots movement spawned from injustice, when in actuality, it's an astroturf movement spawned to create racial agitation / division, civil unrest, and lawlessness, while pushing a Marxist anti-police agenda under the guise of black issues. For the record, BLM's brand of Marxism is inspired by Karl Marx, not Groucho Marx, even though BLM's claim impetus is hilarious like the latter. According to BLM's official website, the movement started, quote, after 17-year-old Trayvon Martin was posthumously placed on trial for his own murder and the killer, George Zimmerman, was not held accountable for the crime he committed, end quote. For the last 3.5 decades, blacks have accounted for more than half of America's homicide victims. Yet, a group that literally calls itself Black Lives Matter somehow didn't care to exist until Trayvon Martin was killed by George Zimmerman. Evidently, not even one of those black-on-black deaths prior to Zimmerman Martin was sufficient to start a Black Lives Matter crusade. Furthermore, during the 503 days between Trayvon's death and Zimmerman's verdict, thousands of blacks were murdered, but their killers didn't have George Zimmerman's pigmentation. They had George Jefferson's pigmentation. So, those lost lives, like the thousands that were killed pre, during, and post Trayvon's life, didn't matter to a group that deliberately named itself Black Lives Matter. Wikipedia states, quote, Black Lives Matter, BLM, is an international activist movement originating in the African-American community that campaigns against violence toward black people, end quote. Am I completely misunderstanding BLM or simply realizing the real lies? Definitely it's the latter. For every Trayvon Martin killed by someone not black, 9 other blacks were murdered by someone black, wrote John W. Fontaine, an award-winning journalist and professor at Roosevelt University. He further elaborated about urban America's murder mania in an article titled, Our Dead Could Fill Our Stadiums. Quote, imagine Soldier Field, home of the NFL's Chicago Bears, filled beyond capacity, brimming with 63,879 young African-American men ages 18 to 24, more than U.S. losses in the entire Vietnam conflict. Imagine the University of Michigan's football stadium, the largest in the U.S., filled to its limit of 109,901, with black men aged 25 and older. Now, add 28,223 more. Together, totaling more than U.S. deaths in World War I. Picture 2 UIC pavilions, home to the University of Illinois Chicago Flames, packed with 12,658 Trayvon Martins, black boys ages 14 to 17, nearly twice the number of U.S. lives lost in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, picture all of them dead. The national tally of black males 14 and older murdered in America over a 30-year period from 1976 through 2005, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, 214,661. The numbers tell only part of the story of this largely urban war, where the victims bear an uncanny resemblance to their killers, end quote. As New York Justice Edward McLaughlin expressed to an urban terrorist during sentencing for an attempted murder, quote, black lives don't matter to black people with guns, end quote. The deniers and apologists may lie about this reality, but the numbers don't. In fact, 2015 saw homicides spike by 33% or more in Baltimore, St. Louis, and New Orleans. BLM's website reveals just as much about its non-actions as its actions. Firstly, judging from BLM's body of work, the term Black Lives Matter should have an asterisk. Clearly, only a specific kind of black life matters to the Black Lives Matter movement. Secondly, the more accurate name and hashtag is Black Lives Matter when taken by whites. I'm guessing that this phrase is too long and, more importantly, too honest for t-shirts. So BLM settled for the first three words. The old versus new. Although BLM is tethered to the RGI, it wants to become an independent movement with discernible differences between itself and the grievance vampires of old. At a rally in St. Louis for Michael Brown, a rapper slash BLM activist declared, "This ain't your grandparents' civil rights movement." And veteran civil rights activist Barbara Reynolds agrees. "He's right," wrote Reynolds in her Washington Post article titled, "I was a civil rights activist in the 1960s, but it's hard for me to get behind Black Lives Matter." Quote, "It looks, sounds, and feels different. Black Lives Matter is a motley-looking group to this septuagenarian grandmother, an activist in the civil rights movement of the 1960s. Many in my crowd admire the cause and courage of these young activists, but fundamentally disagree with their approach. Trained in the tradition of Martin Luther King Jr., we were nonviolent activists who won hearts by conveying respectability and changed laws by delivering a message of love and unity. BLM seems intent on rejecting our proven methods. This movement is ignoring what our history has taught. The baby boomers who drove the success of the civil rights movement want to get behind Black Lives Matter, but the group's confrontational and divisive tactics make it difficult. In the 1960s, activists confronted white mobs and police with dignity and decorum, sometimes dressing in church clothes and kneeling in prayer during protests to make a clear distinction between who was evil and who was good. But at protests today, it is difficult to distinguish legitimate activists from the mob actors who burn and loot. The demonstrations are peppered with hate speech, profanity, and guys with sagging pants that show their underwear. Even if the BLM activists aren't the ones participating in the boorish language and dress, neither are they condemning it." End quote. Toronto Black Lives Matter co-founder Yusra Kugali used Facebook to set the record straight regarding the change of the guard. She also updated whites on how they'll be impacted by such policy changes. Quote, "What white people don't understand is that this is not like our elders movement. We will snatch your edges and clap back you into ashes. We will also beat that ass, Becky. Run up." End quote. Using coded speech to threaten others gives BLM plausible deniability when convenient. Indisputably, a generational divide has manifested between veterans and rookies. Whether it's Jesse Jackson being booed in Ferguson, Representative John Lewis saying Black Lives Matter protesters should respect everyone's right to be heard, or Representative Elijah Cummings being called derogatory names during the Baltimore riots, the quarrel has gone public. At a rally organized by Al Sharpton's Nan in Washington, D.C., BLM activists stormed the stage after Nan officials reportedly denied them access and claimed that the old regime was attempting to hijack the Black Lives Matter movement. Ashley Yates, co-founder of BLM affiliate group Millennial Activists United, took to Twitter to, quote, air dirty laundry about Sharpton, who praised the young leader's work at a summit convened by the White House, but never joined their protests or attended any action planning sessions. Moreover, Yates claimed that Sharpton had not a single word to say to the young activists when the meeting was over. The consensus of the new generation is that Sharpton wants to claim these splinter groups without showing any substantive interest in the work they've been doing. Pastor Danny Givens Jr., the clergy liaison to Black Lives Matter in Minneapolis, stated that they, quote, "the old guard, want to co-opt the Black Lives Matter movement by presenting an olive branch and unity in order to promote their own agenda." These are preachers who have been doing this for 30 years or more, and they don't want to make room for the next generation of faith leaders. End quote. During a NAM meeting, Shakedown Sharpton forcefully responded to the youngsters' sentiment and tried to convince them that they're being manipulated by others. Quote, "It's the disconnect that is the strategy to break the movement. And they play on your ego. Oh, you are young and hip. You're full of fire. You're the new face. All the stuff that they know would titillate your ears. That's what a pimp says to a hoe." End quote. Sharpton essentially wants to control BLM's trajectory / development and complete the training of the fledging activists. Only then will they be able to fully join the dark side. In January of 2016, the Christian Science Monitor highlighted BLM's rebuke of a top-down leadership. Quote, "In years past, the civil rights mantle of Martin Luther King Jr. was taken up by other charismatic leaders, political figureheads, such as Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, each a skilled orator with roots in the Black church, which in many ways is still the center of community life and politics for Black Americans. But as the country remembers Dr. King on Monday, a new generation of activists is doing things differently. Many within the Black Lives Matter movement are uncomfortable with venerating any great man of the past, and they reject the idea that any dynamic figurehead should embody their struggle today. Younger protesters are doing much of their work through social media, and they're deciding that the social conservatism of many Black churches is part of mistakes of the past. Many of these activists also say that the Black Lives Matter movement owes a greater debt to the organizing principles of Occupy Wall Street than to the civil rights movement." End quote. Although BLM is comprised of individuals growing up in an America that's vastly different from their predecessors, i.e., Mississippi isn't still burning, Jim Crow is dead, there's a Black first family, etc., the grievances inexplicably remain the same. Oprah Winfrey, critical of BLM's lack of leadership, voiced her concerns during an interview promoting Selma, the film she produced about the 1965 protests in Alabama over voting rights for Blacks. The queen of the RGI told People magazine, quote, "I think it's wonderful to march and to protest, and it's wonderful to see all across the country people doing it," she says. "But what I'm looking for is some kind of leadership to come out of this is to say, this is what we want. This is what we want. This is what has to change. And these are the steps that we need to take to make these changes. And this is what we're willing to do to get it." End quote. The response from BLM supporters was swift. The verdict was in. Oprah was guilty of being an out-of-touch elitist. The judgment made her clutch her pearls. Black Lives Matter is demanding to be the face of the victimization narrative this century. They're not waiting for the torch to be passed. However, understand that the differences between the old schoolers and new schoolers are tactical, not philosophical. BLM strategy. If the only tool one has is a hammer, everything tends to be treated as nails. That's BLM's conflict resolution approach. BLM merges some traditional civil rights era strategies with social media blasts to its tactic of direct confrontation. And voila, a toxic brew of grievances via coordinated chaos is then poured onto society. Philip Agnew, co-founder of the BLM affiliate group Dream Defenders, told reporters, quote, "We and people around the country are going to continue to take to the streets. We're going to continue to disrupt the daily order and ensure that business doesn't happen as usual until something happens for the people in our communities and we see some meaningful reform and clear indications from not only the president's office, but from governors, mayors, and police chiefs and officers around this country that Black lives do truly matter." End quote. BLM is powered by negative energy placed into motion. In other words, it's sustained by an emotion, energy plus motion, that's negatively charged. This emotional instead of logical approach can easily be seen and verified through its protest methodologies. It is unconcerned with the fact that these antagonizing ploys for immediate gratification have caused long-term irreparable damage to his reputation. Admittedly, BLM does an excellent job of disruption. But just as atheists are quicker to burn a Bible than a Quran, BLM knows its limits. BLMers will hit soft targets or low-hanging fruit, places that have no influence or even played a part of the quote-unquote oppression. Interestingly, BLMers never attempt to disrupt the flow of anything in the black community that will potentially stop black-on-black homicides. Overall, the protests are attention-whoring endeavors. And when an actual tragedy occurs that takes some shine away from BLM, such as the Paris attacks, BLM supporters will huff and puff as if victimization is BLM exclusive. How dare other people besides BLM receive attention for their suffering? The audacity, the nerve. Demonstrations. Apparently, stores, malls, city streets, and highways across America are oppressing blacks and thus need to be confronted. BLM has disrupted activity at many innocuous places, unworried that the commotion may ultimately hurt the very people it claims to serve. Still, they triumphantly detail their activity on social media with incident-specific hashtags. Here's a hashtag that BLMers should consider, especially during the busy holiday season. Hashtag Black Jobs Matter. Clearly, black jobs didn't matter when they shut down Minneapolis's Mall of America in 2015, America's largest shopping mall. Cutting off his nose to spite its face is a standard RGI ploy. Comedian slash activist Dick Gregory once called for a boycott of Florida's tourism and agricultural industries, specifically Disney and orange producers, to help eliminate the stand your ground laws, while racial grievance guru Jesse Jackson told CNN, quote, "No doubt, the inclination is to boycott Florida, stop conventions, to isolate Florida as a kind of apartheid state," end quote. One cold winter day in January 2015, a group of BLM demonstrators hopped out of a rented van on Interstate 93 in Massachusetts, unrolled barrels, each filled with 1,200 pounds of concrete, and chained themselves to the barrels. Thousands of commuters were inconvenienced, particularly an ambulance carrying an 83-year-old man who was seriously injured when his pickup truck skidded on ice and smashed into a stand of trees. Due to the BLM-induced congestion, the ambulance had to be diverted from a nearby hospital in Boston to one in Brockton, delaying this senior from receiving necessary hospital care in the process. State police and firefighters had to saw the barrels and tubing loose to clear the highway. 12 protesters were arrested, and at their sentencing, heard an impact statement from the 83-year-old man's daughter. Also, the judge called the protesters' actions foolish and added, quote, "One man in an ambulance had a beautiful life that mattered," end quote. The protesters never explained how shutting down a major highway helped their cause. Oh, it didn't. Political rallies. When was the last time BLM crashed a corner of drug dealers? Oh, I remember. It happened somewhere around the time when the cow jumped over the moon. Instead of confronting the urban corner clusterers, crashing political campaign rallies using intimidation tactics is prioritized. Even if the candidates such as Senator Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton play for BLM's team. Assumingly, Senator Sanders, a socialist, who wants to give away more free stuff than other Democrat politicians do and calls for an end to over-policing in black neighborhoods and systemic racism, is adored by BLM. Within a month span, the group made its presence felt at two of his speaking engagements. MSNBC reported on the second encounter that occurred in the liberal utopia of Seattle, Washington. Quote, "We're shutting this event down now," said an activist who suddenly leapt on stage. She approached the microphone where Sanders had just begun speaking, thanking attendees for welcoming him to one of the most progressive cities in the United States of America. An event organizer attempted to stop the activists, and a heated exchange ensued as the crowd booed. Eventually, activist Marissa Johnson was allowed to speak. "I was going to tell Bernie how racist this city is, even with all of these progressives. But you've already done that for me. Thank you," she said, as some in the crowd called for her arrest. Johnson then asked for a 4.5-minute moment of silence to honor Michael Brown Jr., the black teenager who was killed by police in Ferguson, Missouri, a year ago. As the crowd grew more agitated, Johnson added that Sanders says he cares about grassroots movements, but the biggest grassroots movement in the country right now is Black Lives Matter. Sanders stood by silently the entire time. Eventually, organizers decided to end the event, and the Vermont senator did not return to the microphone. End quote. Although Bernie Sanders was an active participant of the 60s civil rights movement, and his record on fighting for civil rights is longer than the weaves worn by BLM's professional disruptors, none of it mattered to their short-sighted, estrogen-driven agenda. Senator Bernie Sanders certainly felt the burn after his threesome with those two female BLMers. Hillary Clinton, wife of former President Bill Clinton, who was affectionately called America's first black president by blacks, hosted a private $500 per plate event. Black Lives Matter activists crashed her Grey Poupon-laden soiree, demanding that she account for some of her past statements on racial justice. A party crasher carried a sign that quoted Hillary's 1996 statement regarding at-risk youth. It read, "We have to bring them to heel." BLM claims that, as First Lady, she supported her husband's 1994 crime bill, which led to an increase in mass incarceration, three-strike federal sentencing laws, the elimination of rehabilitative programs for drug abuse, and emphasized prison construction, all of which disproportionately affected blacks. Hillary should have reminded BLM that she's married to an honorary black man and thus exempt from black criticism. Alternatively, her campaign stated that different policies make sense at different times. Therefore, today's Hillary Clinton is calling for, quote, "facing up to the reality of systemic racism," end quote, and ending the school-to-prison pipeline. In other words, she's speaking from both sides of her mouth. When BLM protesters appeared at a Hillary campaign event in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Bill Clinton vehemently defended his 1994 crime bill and even had harsh words for the heckling BLMers. America's first unofficial black president was suddenly acting white. National Public Radio reported, quote, "He said the bill lowered the country's crime rate, which benefited African Americans, achieved bipartisan support, and diversified the police force. He then addressed a protester's sign, saying, 'I don't know how you would characterize the gang leaders who got 13-year-old kids hopped up on crack and sent them out onto the street to murder other African American children,' Clinton said, addressing a protester who appeared to interrupt him repeatedly. 'Maybe you thought they were good citizens. You are defending the people who kill the lives you say matter. Tell the truth. You are defending the people who cause young people to go out and take guns.'" End quote. Bill Clinton violated a major tenet of the Democrat Party: never speak about black apathy and hypocrisy regarding pervasive black crime. Only reinforce positive black imagery. Additionally, embrace and appreciate any verbal abuse from blacks, regardless of its hostility level. After all, blacks are going to vote for the party anyway, so grin and bear it. Noticeably, the lynch mob did not and will not hold the Congressional Black Caucus, the CBC, accountable for endorsing the 1994 crime bill. The feigned rage is simply another blame whitey scenario for black people's problems, and then guilt trip whites into fixing these problems. Even though Clinton Inc. and other limousine liberals are amongst a dwindling group that still tolerates BLM's temper tantrums, tolerance from typical white liberals in the real world has to be waning. It's obvious that BLM wants friends, but doesn't want to be a friend. Die-ins. A die-in, sometimes known as a lie-in, is a form of protest where participants simulate being dead. In the simplest form of a die-in, protesters simply lie down on the ground and pretend to be dead, sometimes even covering themselves with signs or banners. At the finish line of the 2015 Twin Cities Marathon, one of the BLM die-in signs read, "Fuck your finish time." The insincerity of BLM die-ins is that its die-ins never occur in places where blacks are literally dying, such as the hood. BLM's die-ins are simply grandstanding gestures in front of non-threatening whites. Hashtag Black Brunch. Under the hashtag Black Brunch, BLMers invaded restaurants, diners, or eateries frequented by whites in affluent or gentrified neighborhoods. The best diners to disrupt were the hipster diners. Apparently, they are hotbeds of police brutality. While white hipsters enjoyed their overpriced omelets and Pabst beers, BLMers would read the names of black people killed by cops, and they didn't use their inside voices while reading. Instead, they yelled and behaved as if they possessed the absolute moral authority to castigate the patrons for eating while white. Although visibly bewildered, the customers would usually pause until the storm passed. Yet another protest in a place that has nothing to do with the reason for the protest. I guess these space invaders view brunching while white as another white privilege. Vendetta equals violence. The RGI knows that resentment against whites is a core emotion within blacks. And as Jedi Master Yoda sagely identified, anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering. Indeed, the underlying antipathy has led to suffering from the victim mindset and violence against whites. And yes, I've actually used a Yoda quote. Dr. Thomas Sowell, the intellectual juggernaut, noticed the pattern of attacks and concluded that a black and white race war is in effect. He wrote, quote, "Initial skirmishes in that race war have already begun and have in fact been going on for some years, but public officials pretend that it's not happening and the mainstream media seldom publish it at all, except in ways that conceal what is really taking place," end quote. Former Congressman Alan West echoed Dr. Sowell's sentiment and added, quote, "We were supposed to be living in a post-racial America since we elected the first African-American president. That's hardly the case," end quote. I have a tremendous amount of respect and admiration for these men. They're not RGI members or stockholders of victimology. Contrarily, these black men are straight-shooting realists who emphasize critical thinking over critical complaining. Moreover, they want to do what's right for America instead of what's best for a few Americans. However, despite my admiration, I disagree with their assessment that the continued black-on-white violence indicates a present or future race war. A race war requires at least two engaging races. The reoccurring black/white interracial violence is statistically overwhelmingly one-sided. More whites are killed annually by blacks than vice versa. Still, I maintain that it's not a race war. These assaults are simply considered payback. And this payback has been happening for decades with the RGI's blessings. White victim plus black culprit equals payback/racial revenge. Since whites are generally perceived by blacks as universal oppressors who constantly use institutionalized racism as a weapon of mass black destruction, black-on-white offenses are typically regarded as justified payback for white persecution. Actor Jamie Foxx exemplified this mindset while promoting his movie Django Unchained. He joyously proclaimed, quote, "I kill all the white people in the movie. How great is that? And how black is that?" End quote. Imagine a white actor saying, "I get to whip black people in the movie. How great is that? And how white is that? Even the white liberals who proudly display their Hope and Change bumper stickers and Black Lives Matter sympathies can't escape the perception that whites are inherently racist. In fact, white liberals are simply viewed as whites who internalize their racism, whereas white conservatives are considered shamelessly racist. The former may actually be despised more than the latter. Either way, the victim mentality emphasizes that good and bad whites are simply opposite sides of the same coin. George Yancey, a black professor of philosophy at Emory University, blatantly stated in his New York Times article, Dear White America, that, quote, being a good white person or a liberal white person won't get you off the hook, end quote. Black-on-white violence rarely receives condemnation from the black press, and unsurprisingly, the mainstream media also conveniently overlooked this pattern of racial violence. It conflicts with the portrayal of blacks as permanent victims and capable of being racist. Therefore, the non-coverage is just another instance of the corporate media spitting at the public and reporting it as rain. Undoubtedly, white resistance is surfacing, and I believe this observation sparked Dr. Soul's commentary. Nevertheless, the mounting white backlash is more of an awareness campaign and shedding of white guilt than one of violence. Dr. Soul also mentioned that he was appreciative that old age may spare him from seeing a race war. I say, enjoy the remainder of your earthly time because there is not and will not be a race war. Laughably, the new Black Panthers have been endlessly calling for a race war, but the new Black Panthers are as relevant on race matters as the Carolina Panthers NFL football team. Nonetheless, payback attacks will continue with BLM's tacit encouragement. And sometimes, only divine intervention can postpone those attacks from occurring. Such was the case when Toronto Black Lives Matter co-founder Yusra Kogali used Twitter to beg Allah to stop her from killing, quote, white folks. She tweeted, quote, please, Allah, give me strength to not cuss slash kill these men and white folks out here today. Please, 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 end quote. Moving to Saudi Arabia would solve her problem. Oh, wait, women can't even drive cars there. Payback instances. Most people know the name of that white Hispanic guy who stood his ground in Sanford, Florida. But certainly, many don't know the name of the white Hispanic who didn't stand his ground in Washington, D.C. His name is Chris Marquez, a decorated Iraq war veteran whose bravery inspired two statues. He was brutally attacked and robbed by a pack of black feral teens after they approached him and asked whether black lives matter. The decorated Marine was eating in a McDonald's when the miscreants surrounded him and began yelling, Black Lives Matter. At that point, they demanded he answered the question, do you believe black lives matter? He didn't respond. I felt threatened and thought that they were trying to intimidate me, so I figured I'm just going to keep to my food, eat my food, and hopefully they'll leave me alone, Marquez told WJLA. The youth then started calling him racist, he said. When he proceeded to leave the restaurant, the name-calling spiraled into a physical assault. One of the teams hit him in the head from behind, knocking Marquez unconscious to the ground, where the gang beat and robbed him. Marquez told police that one youth hit him in the head with what he believed was a handgun, which couldn't have been the case because D.C. has a gun ban. Surely this criminal wouldn't dare violate the gun ban. The veteran, who has survived ambushes in Fallujah, awoke on McDonald's sidewalk with his pants ripped and his wallet containing $400 in cash, three credit cards, and his Veteran Affairs medical card, amongst other things, stolen. Washington, D.C. police said that they weren't considering the incident a hate crime. It takes no imagination to envision the black ethnic response had the Marine shot and killed the domestic assailants, as he once did foreign assailants. Info about Marquez. During his time in the Corps, Marquez was deployed to Iraq three times and Afghanistan once. He served 8 years on active duty in the Marines as a rifleman and scout sniper from 2003 to 2011, and was awarded a Bronze Star for valor on his first deployment for carrying his commander's body out of combat after he died in an ambush. Marquez is the subject of the No Man Left Behind statues at Camp Lejeune and Camp Pendleton, depicting him and another man holding up a wounded soldier at the Battle of Fallujah. Two white teens, Jordan Bobbish and Jacob Kula, were murdered execution style in a Detroit field, and their lifeless bodies were discovered days later. They were robbed, tortured, and then murdered after trying to buy drugs. Their black killers, Frederick Young and Philando Hunter, were sentenced to life in prison. During the sentencing, the victim's family read impact statements. Jacob Kula's mother lamented, "Not only did the defendant take away my son's future, he took away my future as a mother, my future as a grandmother." Jordan Bobbish's mother grieved, "I have sorrow in my heart, soul, and every fiber of my being today, and I will carry that with me for the rest of my life." After hearing their touching statements, defendant Frederick Young has something to say to the court. He wanted to apologize, BLM style. Quote, "I like to say sorry to the families of Ayanna Jones, Michael Brown, Eric Gardner. I want to apologize to them for not being able to get justice for their loved ones who was murdered in cold blood. And in respect for the peaceful protests, I want to say, hands up, don't shoot. Black lives matter. That's it, Your Honor." End quote. With no apology to his dead victims or their eternally impacted families, I was hoping that he'd at least apologize for being born. BLM investors. Rapper Jay-Z and his wife Beyoncé are huge supporters of the Black Lives Matter movement. In fact, Mike.com reported that Jay-Z's global music and entertainment platform, Tidal, in association with Roc Nation, planned to donate $1.5 million to Black Lives Matter and several other local and national social justice organizations. The majority of recipients are social justice groups and organizations specifically committed to ensuring the nation understands that Black Lives Matter. Tidal strategically made the announcement about his donation on what would have been Trayvon Martin's 21st birthday. The money was raised from a sold-out charity concert held in Brooklyn, New York, which featured Beyoncé, Nicki Minaj, Jay-Z, Lil Wayne, and Nick Jonas. Jay-Z and Beyoncé's philanthropic endeavor shouldn't be surprising. During the Ferguson fiasco of 2014 and Baltimore tsunami of 2015, hip-hop's first family secretly bankrolled tens of thousands of dollars in bail money to protesters. Dream Hampton, Jay-Z's ghostwriter for his book Decoded, publicized the power couple's covert financial support in a sequence of tweets before quickly deleting them. In one tweet, she wrote, "When we needed money for bail for Baltimore protesters, I asked, hit Jay up, as I have for Ferguson, wired tens of thousands in minutes." In a follow-up tweet, she wrote, "When BLM needed infrastructure money for the many chapters that we're growing like beautiful dandelions, Carter's wrote a huge check." Her third and final tweet mentioned that there was too much stuff to list, but they, Jay-Z and Beyoncé, always insist folk keep quiet. When the New York Daily News requested that she confirm her comments, she doubled down on her statements via email. Quote, "I can say I've personally helped facilitate donations they've given to protesters directly and that they never asked for anything in return, especially publicity." End quote. I wonder why they don't contribute to the witness relocation program to combat the no snitch mentality. The money contributed by hip-hop's Barack and Michelle Obama is merely pennies on a dollar when compared to the money dispersed by the chief financier of BLM's instigated methods of social justice, left-wing billionaire George Soros. In an online poll conducted by Human Events, George Soros was voted, quote, "the single most destructive leftist demagogue in the country," end quote. In 1998, Soros wrote, quote, "insofar as there are collective interests that transcend state boundaries the sovereignty of states must be subordinated to international law and international institutions, end quote. According to Soros's private foundation tax filings uncovered by the Washington Times, Soros donated $33 million to dozens of different social justice organizations to help turn events in Ferguson, Missouri, from a local protest into a national flashpoint. The billionaire's funding financed the busing of professional organizers from Washington, D.C. and New York into Missouri. The numerous organizations reportedly created their own online echo chamber by using their extensive social media presences to synchronize likes, reposts, and comments on articles reflecting their point of view. BLM is just one of his pawns to push other agendas to divide America. It is cannon fodder for a broader battle. Soros knows that a house divided against itself cannot stand. Hashtag cut the check. Famed BLMer DeRay McKesson quit his school administrator job in Minnesota to become a professional protester for the RGI. So, what happens when the RGI's money doesn't trickle down to its higher agitators in a timely fashion? Naturally, the employees will become restless and bite the hand that's supposed to feed them. When Ferguson became ground zero for racial frenzy, the RGI's rent-a-mob tactic caused dissension after the hired protesters didn't receive their pay. Suddenly, the only black lives that mattered to the professional protesters were their black livelihoods. Hashtag, black livelihoods matter. As a result, they created a cut the check hashtag and even held a sit-in at the offices of MOR, Missourians Organizing for Reform and Empowerment. MOR is the updated Missouri branch of ACORN, Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, which filed for bankruptcy in late 2010. Investigative journalist and author Matthew Vadim uncovered that MOR has been active in the Ferguson protests and efforts to free jail demonstrators so that they can continue vandalizing businesses, intimidating perceived adversaries, setting fires, and throwing projectiles and human waste at cops. Millennial AU, MAU, one of the BLM umbrella groups that participated in the sit-in, wrote an open grievance letter to the white overseers of BLM-related finances and posted it online. Quote, on May 14, 2015, many individuals and organizations of the protest movement that began in Ferguson, Missouri, organized a sit-in in the office of the Missourians Organizing for Reform and Empowerment, MOR. The demand was simple. Cut the checks. Early in the movement, nonprofit organization MOR, formerly known as the St. Louis Chapter of ACORN and local St. Louis Organization for Black Struggle, created a joint account in which national donors from all over the world have donated over $150,000 to sustain the movement. Since then, the poor blacks of this movement, who served as cash generators to bring money into St. Louis, have seen little to none of that money. Furthermore, since the influx of funding has started, poor black people continue to take to the streets, all the while losing their homes, vehicles, ability to feed themselves and their families, and suffering from trauma and mental illness with no ability to afford quality mental health services. Questions have been raised as to how the movement is to sustain when white nonprofits are hoarding monies collected off of black bodies. When will we hold the industry of black suffering accountable? The people of the community are fed up and the accountability begins here and now. This isn't about more. This is about Black Lives and the Black Lives Matter movement, who are literally broke and starving. There is an insidious strand of racism and white supremacy that exists in this movement, and it is called the nonprofit industrial complex. As a byproduct, it provides decent salaries and comfort to many people who are not affected by the disparities that they are trying to address. This money is typically in the hands of white people who oversee the types of services that the nonprofit provides, while having select token black people to spearhead the conversations within and to the community. We need to be thinking about justice for black people, This means white people must renounce their loyalty to the social normalcy that maintains white power and control. If black lives really matter, justice and self-determination for black people will mean the black community will control its own political and economic resources. It is asinine to believe that black people can continue to organize and take to the street when they can barely meet their basic needs. In St. Louis, organizers and protesters depleted $50,000 of the available funds and dispersed it among the people in the movement in no particular order. Jeff Ordower, executive director of MORE, stated that another $57,000 is expected in the next 1 to 2 weeks, in which those funds will also be dispersed to the black people in the movement. Moving forward, we are building a board of accountability within this movement. We must funnel economics into this movement through the hands of black people who are fighting with and for black life. More on this board will be discussed as we develop. End quote. Remember, BLM isn't fighting for equality. It's fighting to generate and maintain salaries. Hashtag Black Livelihoods Matter. Library bans BLM. Majority Black Nashville, Tennessee is ranked number 45 on NeighborhoodScout.com's list of most dangerous cities in 2016. One's chances of becoming a victim of either violent or property crime there are 1 in 20. Relative to Tennessee, Nashville's crime rate is 87% higher than the other cities and communities. So, who did Nashville's chapter of Black Lives Matter place into its crosshairs? Of course, it wasn't Nashville's Black Thugs. That move will violate its hypocritical oath. Refer to hypocritical, not Hippocratic, oath chapter. Nashville's public library was targeted. Black Lives Matter conducted its chapter meetings at the North Branch Library in North Nashville until library officials informed BLMers that events excluding groups of people could not be held inside the city's libraries. BLM accused the library of practicing white supremacy. But the truth, as the truth usually is, was simple. So simple that BLM made it complicated. As a taxpayer-funded entity, Nashville's library system, which has an entire department devoted to civil rights, has a policy that mandates all meetings at their facilities be open to the public and news media. It has an open door, open meeting policy. It wasn't until a complaint from a library patron who saw a BLM advertisement about an upcoming meeting and felt excluded alerted the library staff to Black Lives Matter's exclusionary policy. The library was previously unaware of the group's racist rule, which allows blacks as well as non-blacks of color to attend, but prohibits whites. Naturally, the library's decision outraged Black Lives Matter, who then responded with its standard blame game talking point. Due to white supremacy in our local government, this week's BLM general body meeting location has changed, BLM posted on its Facebook page. We were surprised about it, but we shouldn't have been, a BLM member told the Tennessean paper of the library's decision. We kind of know the history about how this goes in this country. It's definitely something we want to make public to tell people what's going on in the city. The group moved its meetings to a church where I assume is susceptible to yell racism while practicing racism. I only pray that a wise soul in that church humbly asks, "What would Jesus do?"